I think the reason I like rock and roll so much is because it's really not music. It's as much theater as it is music. And then people will say things like, well, yeah, well, that's for Kiss, but what about the Grateful Dead? And I'm like, you think that Jerry Garcia, the multi-gazillionaire, would be wearing ratty, dirty jeans and like a tie-dye shirt with his belly hanging out if that wasn't part of his image? If he had never made it as a rock star and he was a 70-year-old middle manager, you think that's how he would be dressing?
Are you new to working from home? Maybe you're figuring out how to manage a distributed team. Are you homeschooling your kids while trying to get something, anything else done? You've come to the right place. Work Life at Home talks with both newbies and experts as we explore the tools, tips, and techniques that will help you make the most of this new way of working. I'm Josh Freeman. Welcome home. If you're working from home, you face challenges. The challenge of being seen, of connecting with other people, and of having some kind of impact while you're isolated and opportunities seem limited. But what if they're not? What if you already have the tools at your disposal to get your ideas across to the world anyway? What if you, or that cause you support, or that company you want to start, can get noticed and develop a following even in the face of our current isolation? In a lockdown world, drawing a crowd is something we now need to do virtually, but that's not so different from what people and companies had to do before the pandemic. The internet played a huge role then, and it plays an even bigger role now. My guest, Michael F. Shine, has spent the last 10 years advising individuals and companies on effective ways to become a thought leader, the go-to expert in their industry. And now he's put that advice in book form so it can be used by anyone interested in making a difference, including those of us who work from home. Hi, Mike. Welcome to Work Life at Home.
Hey there. It's great to be here.
So your new book may have the longest title in the world. You want to tell
subtitle.
The listeners what it's called?
The subtitle. You can just call it by its regular title.
All right. Well, say the whole thing for
people. All right. So the book is called The Hype Handbook. And the subtitle, I was inspired by Borat for this one. It is 12 indispensable success secrets from the world's greatest propagandists, self-promoters, cult leaders, mischief makers, and boundary breakers.
Right. Okay. So hype. Hype is a provocative term, and I'm sure you picked it because it is. So why don't we talk about what it really means and why hype is important?
So I would say I half picked it because it's provocative. You know, most people do consider the term hype a negative thing. I mean, what it typically means to most people is that you're blowing smoke around something that doesn't have much inherent value.
Right.
However, there's one community that hype has always been considered a positive thing, and that's the world of hip hop, where in hip hop groups, there was always someone known as the hype man, and the hype man was so important that they were often an official member of the group, and they would often rap, they would get the crowd excited, they would sometimes work with the street teams. And to me, all hype means is any activity that is designed to attract attention and get people highly emotional so that they take an action that you want them to take. It can be a negative action, it can be a positive action, but often people who don't have access to straight ahead traditional ways of doing things, like the early hip hop artists, they accept that hype is an important thing and the rest of us kind of poo poo it.
Which is really interesting because we do definitely associate it with negative stuff. And I totally get that it's just, you know, it's a way of getting people engaged. So one of the ways that people traditionally used to become famous is publishing. They would do books. And I know that you've talked about books not being the way in anymore because I guess it's so ubiquitous and there's so many bad ones out there. But if we've got books and we've got blogs and we've got zines and websites, anybody can publish anything. So how does that change how we promote ourselves? Like, what part of hype is that?
Well, I would say that a book can still be really important. So for example, my book came out with McGraw-Hill, which is a mainstream publisher. And a lot of people said to me, you know, the publishing world now expects you to do all the marketing anyway. Why wouldn't you just self-publish and keep all the royalties? And there are a few reasons, but one of the main reasons is that having that McGraw-Hill on the spine is a symbol of authority.
Yeah.
And all hype artists know that symbols of authority matter a lot because our brains are not designed to see the world accurately. They're designed to help us survive and spread our genes. And we don't have time to, you know, assess all the inputs that are coming at us. So when you see something like a doctor's white coat or a mainstream publisher, that goes a long way to read between the lines of what you're asking. Beyond that, you know, if we can publish blogs and social media and all of this, it becomes difficult to know if what we're doing is effective. I think it's really important to not just randomly publish things or randomly publish a book. It's important to publish the right kinds of stuff. So let's take the book example.
Yeah.
If you're writing just a random book called, I don't know, in business, Leadership Strategies for the 21st Century. Well, there are a million books like that, right? I mean, that's going to get lost. However, if you create some, I call it a Bible, some like blueprint for how everything in the world works, like 7 habits of highly effective people. If you learn these 7 habits, doesn't have to have a number, by the way, but that's one way of doing it. But this is like to become an effective person. This book has all the answers. That turns you into a guru and a real notable figure much more effectively.
So I wanted to ask you about that. That's one of the things I was curious about is like, how do you have the, I don't know, how do you have the balls to say that you have the 7 definitive answers to anything? That's a really strong position to take. And also fraught with, to me, it's just instant red flags of like, oh, please, you know, you can't possibly have all the answers. But I know it's part of the deal. So how does that work?
So, I mean, I don't think you need to lie and I don't think you should lie. I don't think you have to come out in black and white and say, read this book and it has all the answers. I think it's more subtle than that. I think it's how you sort of frame things. I think it's about getting rid of qualifying words. So here's an interesting thing. We know that very intelligent people often do second guess themselves because nothing is direct. There's always 2 or 3 or 4 sides to every story, but that can really blow up on you. So when I was in college, when I was in late high school, I had written a book that was published by Macmillan. It was a humorous driver's manual, and it ended up selling very few copies, but it came very close to selling millions of copies because when I was in college, I got a call from Oprah, from the Oprah show, not the woman herself, but a representative on my phone in my dorm out of the blue.
Wow.
And it was very weird. And they said to me, we heard about your book, which was brand new, and we are doing a show on whether the driving age should be made, you know, older or not. What do you think? And I said, well, there's 2 sides to it. If you lower it, it's this, and these are the pros and cons. And they never called me back because they were looking for someone to say that the driving age should be raised because of this or the driving age should be lower. So the fact of the matter is that equivocation, it's not as persuasive or attractive to large masses of people.
So that's a really interesting thing. So if you are a rational thinker, you're in trouble. Basically,
I guess it's about framing. You know what I mean? In other words, it's about when you introduce things. So if you write a book called How to Win Friends and Influence People, if the first book that Dale Carnegie ever put out was how in certain circumstances you might increase your social capital unless you're in a disadvantaged environment, that probably wouldn't have sold very well. But, you know, you need a hook. You need to open people up to new ideas that they wouldn't be open to. And once you have them in your circle, you can become a little more nuanced. You know what I mean?
Yeah, sure.
But you need to appeal to that animal brain to give people a chance to learn what you're all about. And that doesn't mean lying. It means radically simplifying things.
Right. I mean, you see it in politics all the time, of course, but you see it in business. You see it in lots of places because there's too much stuff out there for us to be able to even contemplate. It's just the massive amount of information is nuts.
Where I do see people going wrong, and I've been one of them, are the kind of people who I'm assuming listen to your show, are small business people who work at home. You know, a lot of them are very, very smart and very, very nuanced in their thinking. And they just feel that because they have good ideas, they can just lay out their ideas in all of its fine complexity. And then they wonder why they're not building the big, massive Simon Sinek-sized audiences. And that's often why.
Yeah, it's like when you think of what, for example, what advertising people do or what public relations people do. And, you know, it's weird because this is kind of what I do for my clients. I try to distill what they're doing down to something that's simple and that is clear and where the thing that you're communicating has an idea that you are presenting. And mm-hmm. it doesn't mean it's all they do, but it means it's all we're focusing on for right now. This is a simple, single message that needs to get across. And that's what we do for a living, you know, but doing that for ourselves is always difficult. And I assume that's where you got the idea of being a consultant to other people, because it's got to be simpler for you to go into a client and say, hey, you know, we need to get this down to a statement. What's the statement? And work with them to till they're clear. Is that pretty true?
Yeah, you're exactly right. I would say, I mean, you know, I own an agency called Microfame Media, and we do these campaigns. I mean, they're, you would think of them as marketing campaigns, but I call them hype campaigns, when we can mm-hmm. talk about why I think marketing is a loaded concept. But I think a lot of times the one thing I would add to that is that companies and people try to boil their thing down into a simple statement, and that's half of it. Mm-hmm. I think the thing that can even take that up a notch is turning it into a contrarian statement or point of view. So I don't mean controversial, but what I mean is, what is everyone saying in your industry that's just considered like gospel and that you disagree with? Because if you don't have something like that, especially if you're in an information or services business, you're going to be an also-ran. Why are you in business? If you're just taking the same point of view as everyone else, then you should reconsider that, right? But it's important to communicate that. And there are so many examples of people who have done that well. I think that's an added layer that leads to success rather than just having an elevator speech.
Well, let's talk about that. So contrarians, I mean, the world is full of contrarians, and you cite some great examples in the book, which we should definitely talk about. So let's do two examples, if you could. One is, give us an example of somebody who's a contrarian who is a horrible person. Okay. But very successful. Cause I know that's one of the sources of this. And then give us an example of somebody who's doing it really well for something that's really positive.
So I'm trying to think of a contrarian who's a horrible person that I feel comfortable, you know, saying is a horrible person. Right. I mean,
how about a controversial person that we all know? Somebody like that.
Well, I'll give you the horrible person first. So cult leaders do this a lot, right? Mm-hmm. So the thing is, human beings are literally chemically and genetically wired. We bond with other people based on what everyone is against. So there's anthropological research on this, which we can discuss. But basically, oxytocin, the chemical that everyone thinks of as the cuddle drug that makes us bond with our children and our spouses and whatever else, is the same brain chemical that's responsible for racism and for hating people with different political ideologies.
It's so weird.
It's very weird. And why that is because we bond with people that we perceive as being like us, as being the opposite of something else. And that's, you know, that sounds like a horrible thing about human nature, but you can channel it positively, and we'll talk about why. So cults use this all the time. So the worst thing you can do to hurt a cult is to persecute them. You know, when the Jim Jones thing happened, you know, in Guyana, the way Jim Jones, a terrible person, was able to get those people to get more and more fanatical, go with him to Guyana and ultimately kill themselves. And the same with David Koresh and Waco, is they weaved this narrative whenever something would come on the news about the federal government or that senator or whatever. investigating them and trying to shut them down and take their guns away and this and that, they would say, you see, they're against us. You know what I mean? Yeah. We have the truth and they're against us. And it would just bond these cults just tighter and tighter and tighter together. And the people oppressing them, quote unquote, were trying to do the opposite. So that's something to think about.
Just on a one-to-one, if you have an argument with somebody you disagree with politically, you're going to push them further and further into a corner the more strongly you disagree with what they're saying and the more like facts you throw at them and kind of arguments you make.
Yeah.
It just cements their position. And if anyone does it to you, it's same thing happens. And it's just it's a weird thing in the way that we're structured.
Yeah.
But understanding that is the point.
It's important.
And so who understands it that's doing something wonderful in the world right now?
Well, so there's a company called Basecamp.
I know them well. I use them.
Right. So I don't know that they're furthering the cause of world peace, but it's a great company. I mean, their product is great. It's very simple.
Yep.
It makes project management easier. They have a really interesting philosophy on work. And so they created, for the audience members who aren't familiar with it, a project management software. And this is a quote unquote boring industry, right? But they created a project management software that does only a few things. And before them, that was considered sort of heresy in that space. So the way that project management software was built before that, basically clients would ask you to add some bell or whistle. You would, and then you would roll that bell and whistle out, that feature, to every other client that you ever had. And the idea was that just made your software better and better because now it could do 100 things, 200 things, 300 things.
Right.
And what the guys at Basecamp did is they didn't just say that kind of project management software was bad. They said that kind of work and that kind of way of living was negative. So they picked a fight with that idea. They said that the corporate America of like making everything complex, of 60-hour work weeks, of all of this, that just means you're inefficient. That's a terrible way to live. It's a terrible way to work. Fire your workaholics. They would call out certain business people by name. And Basecamp has like a cult around it. People love Basecamp. And this is a project management software. I mean, how boring is that? But people, I mean, even the way you talked about it, I know it. I love it. I use it, right? I mean, they've engendered that kind of thing. No one talked that way about, I don't know.
I've read two of Jason's books. I know, exactly what you're
Jason,
talking about.
I mean, you know, I'm on a first name basis,
hell yeah.
You know, so, right.
Yep.
So they did that very, very well.
Oh, that's a really interesting example and not one I was expecting.
I should bring that up. That hits the nail on the head, what you just said, because when people hear the word hype and that they're going to learn from propagandists and cult leaders, what they always say to me is, well, why would I want to learn from them? Aren't those terrible people? And I said, yeah, a lot of them are. But human psychology is human psychology. And if you can learn these concepts devoid of the moral sort of associations, because it's completely amoral, not moral or immoral, then you can apply it to anything. You can apply it really ethically to really good projects. So human beings aren't going to stop behaving the way they behave. The only reason more bad people use this stuff is because they're perfectly fine with seeing the world the way it is and manipulating that, where the rest of us let all kinds of emotional baggage get in the way.
Yep. Makes sense. So if somebody wanted to start a project management site now, they would have to contend with Basecamp as the thing they were against, right? They'd have to fight
maybe
back.
Yeah, maybe, you know, that or a third thing altogether. Maybe there's some trend in project management that I know nothing about. But yeah, I would think that would be a really strong thing to do as long as it was real. I think trolling is not the point here. Just like fighting against something to fight when you don't really believe what you're saying and have nothing to back it up, that usually backfires. But if you have a compelling reason to think that what Basecamp is doing is either wrong or doesn't fit for a lot of circumstances and you have a better solution, you should certainly pick that fight.
Sure. It's funny. Just coincidentally, I've had two people as guests who are involved in that area, which is like so weird.
That's
interesting. I don't even know why exactly. I guess it has a lot to do with working from home.
That, yeah,
you know,
that
remote
makes sense.
Teams and all that stuff. But one of the people from Trello was on, and a guy, John Sindler from Dayback, was on, and they both are, you know, different ways of looking at this exact problem.
Yep.
And I'm wondering how they position themselves against against Jason Fried and DHH. That's a really interesting thing.
I've used Trello, and I don't know the other one you mentioned, but I think, and I don't know their relative, you know, financial positions, but I would say that Basecamp is the only one that I know of anecdotally that really has that sort of like fanatical, dedicated following that isn't just like which one solves my business problem better, right, which is how most people assess that kind of software.
Hey, it's Josh. We'll be back in a minute. But first, I want to tell you about my company, Free Associates, which sponsors this podcast. Free Associates is a brand strategy and design agency that's created highly successful, large-scale programs for some very big companies. Tempur-Pedic and Sealy, Kenwood Audio, Elkin Components, Memorex, to name just a few. And we've also worked for plenty of much smaller companies. We've helped brand events like the Bi-Coastal Revlon Run Walk and the Mercedes-Benz Cup Tennis Championship. We've helped for-profit enterprises and nonprofits alike, new brands just starting out, and long-established brands who want to bring their image and identity into the 21st century. And we've done all this as a distributed company with nearly everyone on our team working from home since I founded the firm in 1993. If you've got a brand that needs defining or refreshing, and you want some help from a small firm with big experience, visit freeassociates.net or email me here, josh@worklifeathome.com. Free Associates, fresh, seasoned, ready to help you transform your business. Why don't we talk about some of the other principles in the book besides picking a fight? What's another shockingly valuable thing that bad guys use that good guys can use?
Well, let me speak to one that mischief makers use, which I don't always think is a bad guy, and one that that mischief makers use that's specifically well suited to be repurposed by people who work at home,
right,
and especially in the era that we're in. So theatricality is immensely important in generating emotion and attention, in hyping something up in an ethical way or an unethical way or something in between. When we think of theatricality, we think of things like, gosh, the Grand Guignol, which was a theater in Paris that was the smallest theater in Paris at one time, but had the longest life of any theater in Paris. And again, you would think, of course, a theater is dramatic, but that's that isn't the point here. The point is that they were in an old Gothic cathedral and you would go in there and there would be special effects and gore and blood and guts that had never existed before then. This was like before horror movies, you know, and people would faint in the audience they would have a doctor on staff, and the people who owned the theater, who were really good hype artists, would report to the press that they tried to get the doctor, but the doctor had fainted as well. Right. So you think of theatricality as things like that, or even, you know, or like Tony Robbins or Amway is a great example. I mean, Amway is selling detergent and breath spray and stuff, and people don't even know the names of their products for the most part, but they're so successful that they have an arena named after them. And that's because they get their salespeople worked up into a frenzy. They put them into this big hall. They use lights and rock music and chants and all of this stuff. And it gets people into this transcendent state. So we're like, how can we possibly use theatrical elements, staging and props and, you know, drama and all of that to help us when we work behind a desk at home and we're on Zoom? Well, it's a function of making sure that every interaction you have is well thought out and is aligned with what you do. So there are certain people who they'll have a Zoom call and they figure, you know, I'm at home, so they'll dress kind of nice. I mean, maybe they'll put their button down shirt on, you know, over their, you know, sweatpants or whatever.
Right.
And in the back, you know, they're in some corner of the house, so there's some like wrinkly box in the background. But that's OK, you know, because everyone understands that they're at home. Right. But then there's someone else who, you know, they have their books arranged perfectly to say something about what kind of thinker they are. The artwork they chose behind them is picked to show that maybe they're creative or maybe they have money. You know, if they're a hedge fund manager, maybe they put in expensive artwork or wear an expensive watch to make sure that that's seen. If they're a creative marketing person, maybe they put comic books up behind them, or I don't know. And it's just a function of like figuring out what you have to say to the world and what image you're trying to protect, and realize that everyone's observing you all the time and making subconscious judgments about what you can offer and what you can do, even when you think they're not, in every interaction. And that's theatricality. And those who understand that and pay attention to that, their careers are typically more successful over the long run.
Yeah, that's interesting that you can do that from home, because it is your opportunity, really, to say something about yourself.
Right.
Visually. You see it on, there's so many interview shows now on TV that you see celebrities and how they kind of present themselves to the world. And some don't give a damn. And some clearly are so structured. And so it's such a scene that they've set up that it's almost off-putting, except if you think of who they are, it goes with who they are. I could imagine Lady Gaga would put together some cool, crazy environment for her to be in for a Zoom call. And, you know, Tom Hanks gives you his beautifully designed kitchen cabinets behind him. I don't know. You know, I don't know if that's conscious or not. Last night I was watching, we had taped Colbert, and he was interviewing Stanley Tucci and Colin Firth. And they had somehow managed to have a pure white background for Firth and a pure black background for Tucci. And so Tucci was essentially a floating head, and Colin Firth was this kind of, you know, had this beautiful white environment around him. And it was like the yin and yang or something. It was such a trippy, amazing visual thing. And I apparently they didn't plan it, they said, but I'm not sure.
You know something? So this is a great point, because they're celebrities, and for the most part, celebrities are always conscious about their image. So if a celebrity looks like they don't give a damn, you have to ask yourself if they don't give a damn or if they're trying to say something about not giving a damn, right? So like Trevor Noah, he used to wear suits, and ever since this pandemic started, he wears a hoodie and he's sort of let his hair grow out, you know?
Yep.
Now,
yep.
Do you think that's laziness? No, he's trying to say something about working from home and about how we're all kind of disheveled right now, because he's a political show, you know, so he's not going to wear a suit from his house. I think we can all learn from celebrities. If you look scruffy and look like you don't give a damn, that should be because that helps what you're trying to say. If you own an outfitter company, you know, like a camping equipment company, maybe that makes sense. But if it's just because I'm working at home, no one cares, and you have wires hanging from the ceiling, that's just not paying attention. And people are going to make decisions on that.
That's apathy.
Right. Or ignorance, right? I mean, sometimes we just figure, you know, no big deal. I mean, we're in a work at home environment. It doesn't matter. You know, what's the difference? My content is good. What I'm saying is good. In other words, not everyone who doesn't do that is lazy. It's the same thing where people say, why should I have to hype myself up? Why should I have to promote myself? My stuff is so good. The content of my stuff. It's the same kind of thing. What I'm saying on this meeting is so good. And why should I have to worry about my staging? Because it's a function of how influential you want to be.
Exactly. And so the thing is, if you don't want to be a star, essentially, you don't want to be considered a thought leader in your industry and all that, you just want to have a life, it's fine. But you need to know how this works so you can make a choice, I would think.
If you can sustain that, if you can, if you have a job and all that job depends on is you doing the right thing in your job, and you're okay with the money you're making, and you're really not worried you're going to get fired. I mean, yeah, sure, do what you want to do, you know. But if you are, I would argue though that perception matters at least a little for everybody.
Well, hey, of course, that's why there's a fashion industry. It's why there's a car industry.
Yeah,
right. It's why they have nice watches in the world.
Exactly. You know,
absolutely. But it's a personal choice for sure.
Of course.
You know, you can be the anti that, but you're still making a choice.
Yeah, I always used to say, because I'm a big music fan, and I always tell people, I think the reason I like rock and roll so much is because it's really not music. It's as much theater as it is music. And then people will say things like, well, that's for Kiss, but what about the Grateful Dead? And I'm like, you think that Jerry Garcia, the multi-gazillionaire, would be wearing ratty, dirty jeans and like a tie-dye shirt with his belly hanging out if that wasn't part of his image? If he had never made it as a rock star and he was a 70-year-old called middle manager. You think that's how he would be dressing? That's as much theater as anything else.
Of course. That's right. Yeah. And speaking of rock and roll, why don't we transition into Andrew Luge Oldham?
Oh, yeah. My favorite.
Talk about that. I know you like that. So tell the world.
So what's funny about Andrew Luge Oldham, so he was the manager of the Stones in the early days, you know, in the mid 60s. And he was the ultimate hype artist. And I noticed that he was on Twitter. And I, at the time, I was writing a column for Inc. So I tweeted him and quoted himself to himself. And he liked that. Okay. And he responded to me and I said, hey, you know, can I interview you for Inc.? I was surprised he even responded. He said, yeah, actually, I'm going to be in New York. Do you want to meet me? So I got to have breakfast with him. And it was one of the most interesting breakfasts I've ever had in my life.
Wow,
believe me. Yeah. Like
tell
this guy used to be Keith and Mick's roommate. Yeah, it was crazy.
Wow.
So the Rolling Stones were, before the Rolling Stones that we know, they were a blues band. Mm-hmm. But Mick Jagger was, so it's funny. So the Beatles were actually tough guys. They were actually like, they were from Liverpool, which is a very tough city in the mm-hmm. north. They wore leather jackets. They would get in a lot of fights. They, you know, they were actually like streetwise tough kids. And mm-hmm. their manager cleaned them up and put them in suits and had them bow, you know, and they became yes. a rock band that even parents could like for a while. Mm-hmm. So the Rolling Stones, ironically, were not that. So Mick Jagger went to London School of Economics, which is like Wharton. It's a very, very, very good business school in England. And he was serious about it. In fact, when he mm-hmm. quit to join the Rolling Stones, he wrote them this letter that's really hilarious because it's like, sirs, you know, an opportunity in the music industry has presented itself to me. You know, it's funny. And like Charlie wow. Watts was this jazz guy. I mean, mm-hmm. Keith was actually, he had big ears. He was shy, you know. So and they were from the city. They weren't from they were suburban and from the city of London or from the suburbs. Mm-hmm. So Andrew Luge Oldham was this 19-year-old just like hustler guy who wanted to be famous and wanted to make people famous. And he saw the Stones and he liked their music, but he didn't see an image there. He saw raw material. So he right. said to them, listen, there's already a Beatles. And everyone was trying to be like the Beatles. If you look at the bands at the time, everyone wore suits with skinny ties and the bowl cuts, you know. Mm-hmm. And he said, there's already a Beatles. They're very charming to the press. They're you know, they have this uniform. He said, we're going to be the anti-Beatles. Everything that the Beatles are, we're not going to be. When the press asks you questions, just be rude, mumble, you know, show up in your street clothes. You know, if you have something that you threw on the ground, you know, put that on, you uh-huh. know. Uh-huh. And he basically turned them into the prototypical scruffy rock band that they ultimately fulfilled. I mean, I guess you become what you pretend to be because they became really rebellious people. But his whole thing was that it was inverting. You know, it's similar to picking fights, but a little different. It's if someone is comfortable with something that's already out there and they like it a lot, you can't be completely different because people won't understand it. But if you're the mm-hmm. exact same thing, then why would they go to you? The better right. version is out there. So what you should do is find out what it is and invert it. Take what's already out there and sort of flip the script on it. Make it almost like a bizarro land version of what's out there. And that works really well in a lot of circumstances.
Yeah, it's kind of extreme positioning.
That's a great way to say it. It's extreme positioning. Exactly.
Wow. That's great.
I mean, one way to do this in your own life is to flip your invert your weaknesses. A lot of times we try to bury our weaknesses. And this isn't the same as managing to your strengths. That's what I'm saying is manage to your weaknesses. So sometimes the things about us that we're the most insecure about is the thing that really makes us different. So like Andy Warhol was incredibly shy. They probably would have said that he had social anxiety disorder now. Mm-hmm. And instead of trying to like take Toastmasters classes and overcome his shyness, he mastered this way of communicating that made him irresistible to the press. So someone would say to him, why do you paint pictures of soup? And he would say, I like soup. And the press would just, is he saying something about capitalism? What does he mean? Et cetera, et cetera. And he was just so shy, but he turned it into this mysteriousness. So I would say to somebody who is in a career where they're not trying to become a famous artist or rock star, where they're just trying to manage their perception and market themselves, instead of fighting your weaknesses, what's the flip side of your weakness that can be turned into something compelling or interesting?
So you use your weakness. You go with it and you expand on it if you can.
Yeah, I really believe our strengths are our weaknesses and our weaknesses are our strengths. Like I used to be really insecure. So my father was in business and he's like a hard driving guy, like, you know, not warm and cuddly, especially with people he's working with. Really curt, really can be aggressive. And that served him well. And, you know, in my writing and in my work, I'm not afraid of confrontation at all. I find it fun. But in my interpersonal relationships, I like people to like me, you know? Mm-hmm. And I used to feel insecure about that. And what I realized was almost everything I've ever gotten in my life, it's because I have this personality where people want to help me, where they like me. Instead of trying to bury that, why don't I run with it? So I have a chapter in the book called Create Your Own Secret Society, where I talk about how to build this extremely strong network of people. But that's because I'm very good at that.
I was literally about to ask you about that exact thing. So go ahead. Yeah. Like, let's go there. So that's the flip side of make war, not love, right? That's the complement to it. So how does that go?
Well, so actually, the way I describe that paradox in the book, I basically say you have to pick fights and be contrarian. But at the same time, that doesn't mean going around making everyone you meet an enemy. In fact, it's important to do both simultaneously. So what the best hype artists almost invariably do is they make their success look like it's completely grassroots. Like there's just this groundswell of popularity because their stuff is so good that they gain that million Twitter followers out of nowhere. Mm-hmm. But what they're really doing almost always is building over the years a very strong, I don't even want to call it a network. It's like a club, an old boys group, a group of friends that all has each other's back and pulls strings for each other. Mm-hmm. So what that means is if you want to promote yourself, you should be closely tied in with people who have followings of their own, who have sway of their own. And what you would say to yourself is probably, well, how do I do that? I don't know anybody, or I know some people, but I don't know really powerful people. There are ways to do that. Most people in this world have something that they're craving, even if they have some power in some other area, mm-hmm. that you can give them and you don't even know it yet. And it's up to you to find that. So, I mean, for example, I know this guy, Dave Lindsay, who started a company that's now worth $500 million, and he built it from scratch. So it's, you know, a man who has everything. And I met him. In my case, it was because I was writing articles for Inc. Mm-hmm. But I noticed at some point in the conversation, he said, you know, I just moved from Indiana to New York and I really love live music and I don't know where to go. And as I've alluded to a few times, I love music and I see live music, or did before a year ago. And so I said, oh, I'd be happy to point you around. Now, that was the one thing I could give that guy that he couldn't get from anywhere else. Mm-hmm. At that exact moment, if another week had gone by, he would have found someone else.
Right.
So he ended up becoming a mentor of mine and being life changing for me.
Wow. Yeah. So this is a really interesting thing. People talk about the idea of generosity. Of being generous is a really important thing. And that's essentially what you're talking about. It's like if you look for people who are in a position to do you some kind of good, whatever that is, and you help them rather than being the sycophant, kiss ass, right. or just admiring them or whatever it is, you actually find a way to interact with them in a positive, useful way. You get their affection? I don't know if that's the right word.
Yeah, it's 100% the right word.
I mean, everybody needs some kind of help. And in, you know, what I have found in my, you know, limited scope is that if you are willing to just go out there and be helpful, just participate, you know, it strengthens the connections in your life, in your network. And it also makes you feel good. So there's that, you know, you get personal benefits out of it. And I think it's a really interesting thing that these hype artists find ways to do that. It sounds so cynical, but it's actually a great way to live that like Mother Teresa did it. You know, it's not just bad guys.
I also think it's really important to not make it formulaic. And what I mean by that is it's become sort of the thing to go out and network. And again, we're trapped in our houses now, but there's other, you know, we hear this advice like make introductions, send people articles, and all of that is good. At the same time, there's a big difference between keeping your ears open and trying to really help people with what they need help with, or just do a kindness. And like, I mean, have you ever had that person who you talk to them and then they send you 52 introductions and they send you like articles, and you know you're on a tickler file where like an article goes out to you every 3 months because you're a prominent person, and it's sort of annoying. Yes. Honestly.
Yeah, because it feels manipulative.
Yeah.
It is manipulative.
And it's nothing, it's manipulative, and also it's not anything you really want.
Right.
It's just like more junk mail, junk introduction. It's a burden. Oh, I have to be introduced to this random person. And then you get on the phone with them and it's like, do you know why they put us in touch? No, not really. Or am I a possible client for you? I don't think so.
Mm-hmm.
But they learned in some book you're supposed to do introductions.
Yep.
So don't Don't be that guy.
You just said, yeah, it's like in the networking groups. You go to a networking group and everybody's exchanging business cards. And it's like, eh, so
exactly.
What? But the guys who are good at networking, the guys who started those groups, you know, typically will say, no, you want to create these real relationships. The whole point is to find somebody that you actually connect with and then to really connect with them. And just, you know, it's like, it's stupid, but it's just making friends. You know, it's like,
and what's wrong with having friends who are in your field who have power that you can also help? You know, we think of that as quote unquote manipulative, but no one is saying you have to give up your old friends, and no one is saying you have to hang out with people you don't like.
Right.
I mean, if someone is worth $50 million and they annoy you, please don't hang out with them. There are other people worth $50 million who are worth hanging out with. And guess what? People know that building relationships is part of business. You know, there's a difference between the friend you had when you were seven and a professional friend. Sometimes they bleed into each other, but they don't have to. Everyone knows how the game is played. And as long as you're not hurting or taking advantage of everyone, that's how people make money, by knowing the right people. There's nothing wrong with that.
That's right. And I really like that idea of like, if you don't actually like the person, forget it. They're going to know, you know, they're going to know it's not going to work, and it's going to make you feel like crap.
Right.
So that's stupid.
Right.
Form relationships with people who you enjoy being around.
Even if they annoy you, even if you don't have a real reason for disliking them, but you just wouldn't hang out with them, just don't.
Yeah, exactly. Because there's plenty of opportunities. There's, you know, billions of people in the world. You have a few choices. It's okay.
Right.
You know, find the person. Okay. What do you mean by give the little babies their milk? Which I have not read yet. I haven't gotten to that part of the book yet.
I know that seems to be everyone's favorite chapter title. I don't know if that's their favorite chapter, but everyone loves that title. It's funny. It's a weird phrase that is used by a lot of religions, not in their main scripture, but like when they're talking about how to convert people.
Yeah,
it's the idea that if you want to get someone to accept a new religion, because new religions, by definition, are weird. And I don't mean to offend anybody. I'm not saying that they're wrong or that they're not true.
Mm-hmm.
What I'm saying is that any new religion, it has an element of the supernatural. So if you said to somebody, you know, I believe in vampires with horns who, you know, live on the lip of a canyon in Arizona, they would say you're insane. But a lot of the things that, if you heard a new religion for the first time, don't sound too far off from that.
Right.
So many new religions start and fail because people just hit you over the head with the craziest sounding stuff, whether or not it's true, the craziest sounding stuff, the most non-workaday stuff.
Mm-hmm.
What the successful religions do, they come in the way you wouldn't give a baby a steak. They come in with the milk. So like Scientology, at its deepest level, when you're like a hardcore Scientologist, again, I'm not sure if this is true, but everyone who's reported on this says it's true. They believe in that aliens, ancient aliens, live on the lip of a volcano, and they implanted themselves in our brains to give us negative thoughts, which subvert us. So that's a strange thing.
Yeah.
You would think.
Yes.
But Scientologists never, ever start with that. If you ever talk to a Scientologist, you don't even know it's a religion. I mean, they say, you know, I'm doing this really cool personal development thing, you know, right. And the center doesn't even look like a church. It looks like an office, but a nice office. It looks like a Google place with all white. There's technology that helps measure. They have personality tests, which we use in a corporate environment.
Right.
It's so close to what we're used to. So the more radical your idea is, the more unusual. It doesn't have to be a religion. If you've created a new technology that could change the world, but that's really unusual and that people would reject. Mm-hmm. I mean, remember, anesthesia was rejected for like 50 years before it hit, which is ridiculous. I mean, the amount of suffering that's caused. People don't like big changes. They're scared of them.
Right.
And so if you have something groundbreaking, introduce it in the smallest possible segments. If you have something that's good, but that's not groundbreaking, that's just a variation on what everyone else is doing, then you need to be bold and theatrical and loud and set yourself apart. But if your stuff's truly unusual, you got to introduce that stuff slow if you want anyone to accept it.
Yeah. So all these people who do products that are, quote, ahead of their time, unquote, what happens is people get scared.
That's right.
They're not willing to accept the weirdness of the product, and you have to go in with the familiarity. That makes complete sense.
What was that documentary? I forget what it's called. I'm going to get this wrong, but it's called like Magic, General Magic or something. There was this company in the 80s that basically created like the iPad and the iPhone. I mean, their technology was just so ahead of its time. This was like in the era of the Apple IIc or something. I'm getting the details wrong, but they were just so ahead of their time that no one knew what to do with this stuff. They just didn't get it.
Well, that's interesting. I had a client like that called Access Technologies that made the first really capable portable tablet computer.
Huh.
And it ran Windows, full Windows, and it had face recognition. You could talk to it. It had all the stuff that Siri has now, all of that Apple stuff. Its big problem for the time was the physical technology wasn't really up to speed. So it was kind of heavy. It was a big fat thing compared to these slim tablets we have now. You know, it won best product at Comdex. It was an amazing, amazing launch. We did some great work for it. And the problem was that they couldn't actually quite build it up to the level that people needed. And it just wasn't quite there, you know? And so anyway, so they got a lot of returns and they went out of business, sadly.
You know something? Steve Jobs, he's considered this big revolutionary and that he changed the world. And on the surface, he looked that way. Mm-hmm. But in a way, he was sort of the master of milk before meat, because the medium that we're talking on right now, podcasts, we forget now that that was named after the iPod because we don't use iPods anymore.
Right.
But podcasts existed, and so did MP3s for a long time in computer terms, a few years before they took over the world. But you needed the right technology to do it. They weren't really listed by name. They were listed by like a code, and you had to understand what it was. And it was being able to download music and being able to download interviews was still great. And the people who loved it, but it was so different than our experience. And even though Steve Jobs' products look great, he included the album artwork on the phone. He included, he listed it by name and artist the way we were used to in browsing in the record store. You know, he knew that human beings can't digest things in an entirely new way. Mm-hmm. And that was, I think, probably more the reason for his success than anything he actually invented, because he didn't really invent very much.
No, he was a really good observer.
Yeah.
And he really had a great sense for how to simplify something so people could get it and make it acceptable, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, milk is simpler than meat, you know?
Yeah. That's great. Well, listen, it's been a while here, and I feel like we could have this conversation and go for another hour. This is really fascinating to me. I love this. So someday. But I feel like I should be respectful of your time, and we should probably wrap it up.
I've enjoyed it. Yeah. Anytime you want me to come back, I'd be happy to do it. This has been a great conversation.
Cool, Mike. Thank you so much. So how about if you tell people where they can get a hold of you online?
Sure. There are a couple of ways. So if you're interested in the book, the Hype Handbook, probably your best bet right now at the time of this recording is to go on one of the online places like Amazon or Barnes and Noble. I mean, I'm certainly a big fan of bookstores and if you can find it there. But, you know, bookstores aren't all open right now. Mm-hmm. You know, my company is microfamemedia.com. I have a site, an author site, Michael F. Schein, S-C-H-E-I-N. However, the best way to keep in touch with me is something I call the Hype Book Club, just because it's something I have a lot of fun with. It's hypereads.com. Basically, I'm always reading very weird but entertaining books to do the kind of research I do on hype. Biographies of some of these characters we've talked about, strange crowd psychology books. And it's they're not only entertaining, they're really good for learning a bunch about some of these tactics. And I started making recommendations of them on a regular basis, and people have really grown to love it. And in fact, I get emails from the community all the time. So if you want to get those recommendations, it's hypereads.com.
Okay. I will definitely go check that out. Thank you. Appreciate you doing this. It's really great to talk with you, and hopefully we'll do it again sometime.
I had a blast.
All right. Take care. Well, that's it for now. If you're new to working from home, you might want to check out worklifeathome.com, where you'll find articles, show notes, and, best of all, a community where you can ask questions and get some answers from people who've been doing this a while. We'd love to see you there. And I would be thrilled to hear what you think and find out who else you'd like to hear from on the show. You can email me at josh@worklifeathome.com. If you're enjoying Work Life at Home, please do let your friends and coworkers know so they can subscribe. Thank you for listening. We'll be back soon.